This is our abduction special. I'm Jerry Pippin, and Elaine Douglas is with us, and she's with JAR, the abduction magazine, and she's the board editor, and she's promised to get more issues out. Is that right, Elaine?
Yes, soon. Very soon we're going to have an issue of JAR, a new issue.
We appreciate you coming on and talking to us about all of this, and the phone calls have been very interesting so far.
I think so. Would you like to talk about the Jim Sparks case?
Yeah, we can. You want to do that right now for a minute?
If you want to,
go ahead.
Have you ever? I don't know if you've ever met Jim. He's a well-known abductee. And his book is 2006. The name of his book is The Keepers, An Alien Message for the...
Yeah, I've had him on the air many times.
Yes. Now, if you...
Now, if I remember correctly, they line him up in a camp, sort of. They lay him down, and... Isn't that right?
Well, Jim Sparks is superficially known because he was trained in an alien language. You know, he's made to sit in front of a screen and practice letters. But the thing is, if anybody wants to kind of get an idea of what the aliens are, what I meant earlier when I talked about behavior modification and capitulation, they should read Jim Sparks' book, because many of the elements that can be found that are very important, the fundamental elements of the behavior modification that is used by the aliens, can be found in Jim Sparks' book. In the beginning of his book, he tells you that he loathes the aliens. He loathes them. He is so brought down and so angry about the fact that they pick him up and keep him prisoner and force him to practice letters and put him through a whirlwind, and that he loathes them. And he's trying everything that he can do to get free himself from their grasp. By the end of the book, he is reverential. He is figuratively down on his knees worshiping the aliens. So that his attitude is completely transformed from the beginning to the end of the book. This process requires several years to consummate. And if you read the book, you will see how they managed to do it. And the elements that they used were 1, trauma, 2, coercion, and 3, narcissism. They took him in, they repeatedly subjected him to trauma. They didn't walk him out of his house. They didn't float him through a window. They set up some sort of a device or a process whereby when he was taken, he found himself in like the eye of a hurricane. Not the eye, that's calm, but in a tornado. His whole body was grabbed and whirled around, and it completely lost control of his body in a terrifying experience that ended up depositing him in one of their places, the alien places. I guess it was a craft or wherever it was that he ends up and it turns into a calm situation. But he was taken in this way, oh, I don't know, 100 times. And it was extremely traumatic to him. And psychologists will tell you that if you want to break people down, traumatize them repeatedly, not just one trauma, but repeatedly. The article I wrote on Jim Sparks, which I published in JAR, is called The Breaking of Jim Sparks, because that's exactly what it was. So the first element they used was trauma. And then the next element they used was coercion. Basically, he's their prisoner, and they force him. They actually hold him immobilized in a sitting position in front of the screen, and they use punishment and torture. they tell him that he's going to have to write these alien letters. And if he protests or he doesn't want to write the letters or he won't concentrate on the task at hand, they introduce very painful experiences and torture to get him to comply. Now, that's the negative side. On the positive side, you see, we were talking earlier about how some abductees report positive experiences, and I was saying things like, well, they take you on Monday and you have a good time, they take you on Friday and you have a miserable time. In the abduction cases, you'll always find this interplay of pleasure and pain. And you find it very much in Jim's case. The way that they seduced him, the way that they got his attention, the way that they captured his mind and persuaded him that their purposes were at least interesting and something that he should encounter, was that they presented him with a long series of short films in which they showed him himself in earlier periods of history. They went all the way back to the prehistoric period. They showed him a film of a group of people in prehistory, cavemen, and there was somebody there who looked just like Jim Sparks. And then they showed him a scene in ancient Rome, and there was somebody there that looked just like Jim. And then they showed him a scene in the 14th century, and there was somebody there that looked just like Jim. And then they showed him a scene from the early colonial period, and there was somebody there that looked just like Jim in the scenarios, these little movies that they showed him. And he remarks, you can read it in his book, he says, the persons that he saw that looked just, they had curly black hair, just like him, and they had this and that, a nose just like him. And he begins to lovingly appreciate these images that are being presented to him that look just like him. And then there's one from the Civil War period, and it looks just like him. And pretty soon, he gets all involved in this, and he turns to the aliens and he says, do you mean you've been following my family line all the way back to the cavemen?
Let's bring in Thomas Reed, who has had some experiences. And Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jerry.
Good to have you. Last time I talked to you, you were down in St. Augustine looking around, thinking about moving back to Florida. Have you made a decision?
Yeah, I love St. Augustine. I just can't get my house here to sell, so it's going to have to wait a little while.
Elaine was talking about with Jim Sparks, we'll get into your details here in just a minute, but did you have anything similar to that?
Well, you touched on one thing that I experienced pretty much what did you touch on with this, like a hurricane type of thing. I've mentioned before, and I think even on your show, that what my brother experienced and I in 1966, we referenced it as almost feeling like we were in a wave from like in the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. You hit a big wave, and all of a sudden it like wraps around you. And you turn, and you're not sure which is up, which is left, which is right, and you get swallowed up in this wave. And then all of a sudden, there's a calm and an empty still and like a complete silence, and it's different. It happens very sudden like that. So that part of it I did find.
Now, why don't you tell our audience a little. Some people have heard your shows on our website and on Inception Radio. You did some great shows with Chase and some other people. Why don't you tell me and our audience in a kind of a brief fashion what actually your abduction experiences were. They started early age, right?
Well, the first case with our family was 1954 with my mother in Moosehead Lake, which was the same fourth week of June that airline heading from New York to London and dispatched that F-94 fighter jet to intercept a couple of crafts. That was 50 miles or so away from my parents when they were in this cabin, if you will. But my brother and I, our first incident that we remember was in 1966. And my parents had a 75-acre horse farm up in Massachusetts, and we found ourselves I know I'm short on time here, so we found ourselves at the corner of a line there, a property line, and we were accompanied by a few figures, if you will. I was first, or some figures behind me, and my brother was last. And we had broke through this line of trees. It was at the top of our property line, probably about 300 yards from the house. And we had walked by, or seemingly walked by, this large rock, and then we came to a wishbone-type tree that we were able to see what looked like a pile of dirt behind it. And it was a little bit lower. We had to step down off this little bit of a ledge, and we came onto this craft that was probably, I would say, 60 feet round, I guess. At the time, it looked like a huge pile of dirt. You know, it was dark. And there was a figure out. If this was the ruler, we came onto the craft about the 6-inch mark. This figure was about the 10-inch mark. And it was nerve-wracking. I mean, I walked up to it first. Again, there was like a calm that comes over you a little bit, and you feel it's going to be okay, and you proceed further. And the closer you go, the more you feel it's going to be all right. And the odd thing was I had reached this craft, what I thought was first, and paused for a moment, and the figure kind of had a moment of still. And the next thing I knew, I was inside the craft, and I was in this white, very bright holding area, if you will. It wasn't that big, but it was part of a hallway. It's like this hallway formed a question mark, and I was at this bottom of this question mark, and it was a very soft, what I was standing on was very soft, and I had a figure to my left now, and that brought me to the right of this angled hallway, and I had actually passed my brother now, but somehow, I guess he was in there first. I don't know how that happened, but he was there. And again, with a figure, he was very stock still. And I went around him to the right and came down the rest of this curvature. It looks like this hallway followed the contour of the craft to the front of this top part of the donut, if you will. If you cut the craft in three parts, I was now at the top part of this donut. And I was handed off, if you will, to another figure that was just inside this doorway. And at that point, it was almost like a guide had taken me and dropped me off, and now I was with this other group, and I was to interact with them, and somehow. But there wasn't really much interaction. I really couldn't understand anything that they were trying to relay to me. And they also projected some images, which Elaine touched on earlier. I was nervous. I kept looking behind me for my brother, who was in the hallway. He didn't come all the way up. He just stayed behind. And so I kept looking over my shoulder for him, and there was a touch on my shoulder, and I looked up. This being was taller than me. I was pretty young, at least so much taller, and I started to feel calm again. It was that moment of, peace, I guess, at that point. And then there was a nod to this individual that was at a table in front of me, and there was a seemingly identical table to the left at about 3 o'clock, and this other table was in front of me just off center, but it would have been about 3 and 9 o'clock, if you will. And they looked the same. Figures were not moving much. They don't move much. They kind of stay where they are. And next thing I know, there was an image that came up that wrapped about from 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock. This entire front of the craft had a star pattern and these bright, much brighter stars, if you will, that kind of formed the shape of what I remember as looking like a boot. And it came off to the left, the boot went to the left. And that was up for a few seconds, I guess. Maybe it could have been more, but that's all I remember it. And then all of a sudden, bang, there was this image of this willow tree, a beautiful willow tree off to the left. And it was a cove, like an inlet. And I'll never forget that. That's the image that's been etched in my head for a very long time. And the first experience, that was really pretty much it. I mean,
say hello to Elaine Douglas, Thomas. I don't think you guys know each other.
Hello, Thomas.
Hi, Elaine. Hey,
how
are you?
Doing?
You emailed me a couple times. I'm doing pretty good. Not bad at all.
Well, that's good. That's real good.
I'm sorry?
That's real good.
Okay.
Elaine, basically, Thomas says this has gone on in his family and his grandmother. Did you tell me, Thomas, once that your grandmother's mother or parents had some sort of experience, or did it stop there with your grandmother?
Well, it started with my grandmother and my mother in 1954 when they were renting a cabin in Maine. It was, again, the fourth week of June. And oddly enough, that's when it's in UFO casebook, because it was in the same time frame that this airline, again, was going from New York to London. And it was the incident where they dispatched a fighter jet to intercept this craft was in Gooseneck Lake, and my parents were at Moosehead Lake. And the only thing dividing these lakes was a waterway. One was just over the line of Canada, and one was in Maine. So, and that was on June 29th, 1954. So they were right there at the same time. So there's a connection there we think that there's some relevance there. So my mother, what happened with her? She had been awoke at I guess it was late at night, and where she basically describes what she felt was being alive in a mannequin, is how she really words it. She heard the cracking of a noise in the room and tried to sit up and experienced a warm gripping sensation that wrapped around her like midsection, and she remembers this kept her in like a horizontal position, and says it was much like living inside a mannequin for several hours. I mean, she struggled to try to drag herself away. She could move her hands at her feet. She was choking. She was hyperventilating, and it was as if they were splitting at the bottom of her bed like a boat going through a wake, and these shorter figures were coming around her bed. And what was odd about that too is that there was a girl there. My Uncle Bob was there, my mother's brother, and had taken his girlfriend as well. And in the morning, they both woke up nauseated and had experienced the same thing in the same cabin in different rooms that night. So that was a tough night for them. And so then nothing really took place again until 1966, and we had something very similar in 77. But it wasn't until 1969 that we really had the four of us together in the station wagon. We were coming back from a horse show in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, actually, and we were heading down Route 7, and I'd competed in a horse show and got a brown ribbon. I was pretty upset about it, so they were taking me out for a bite to eat and ice cream and so on, and on the way back to the house, and so we were getting back a little bit later than normal. It was probably 9 o'clock or so. It was in September, and there was before that, I was in the back seat with my brother, and I was going to give him a fireball, a hot one of those little 2-cent fireballs or whatever, and I was taking it out of the packet. And my grandmother had turned around to look in the back seat to express that she felt he was too young for it. And so once she did so, she saw out the back of the station wagon some lights in the woods done off of the driver's side of the car. Now, she, at the time, really wasn't sure what that was, but because it was so big, she referenced it as looking like a floating strip mall, is what it looked like today to her. And it came closer, and there was flashes of light, but the thing was, the hill on the left-hand side of our road was about 5 feet up, and the trees were above it. So even though she saw it, she lose sight of it because it was kind of above the car and above the tree line. And sure enough, it wasn't much longer. The station wagon came to a... it would stall, like you've heard before. It just kind of went off to the side of the road. My mother controlled it off to the right. And there's this calm that's always been associated with what we experience. It's almost like a barometric change in pressure. And it'd be very silent. And then the car stopped. You could hear the stones coming from the tires on the bottom of the car, and then there was this eruption of crickets, and it was just everywhere. And then the four of us were in this huge holding area that was probably the size of 2 or 3 football fields. And I was at this, there was a wall behind me. I wasn't far off the wall, maybe 2 or 3 feet. And there was a wall to my right that was probably 5 or 6 feet away. And between me and the wall, there were some silver carts. At least they looked silver. And then the rest of this bay area was completely open. There was nothing there at all.
Hmm. Elaine, does this sound familiar, like other people have told you things similar to this, or is his experiences more unique?
I think one of the interesting things he said is in the first account, he was walking toward the craft, and he felt calm, and then he felt increasingly calm. What I have observed, I think that what the aliens are able to do with these implants is that under their control, they're able to evoke just any emotion that they want to evoke. And they have a repertoire. Certainly the emotion that they invoke, which is calming, is something they use all the time because they don't like abductees to struggle because it slows down the operation of what they're trying to do.
Thomas, do you have implants?
I don't believe so, but I have a theory on what calms us down as well, is that low-frequency magnetic field. My brother experienced after we felt that droplets of blood had dropped out of his nose and onto his steering wheel, and we thought perhaps that low-frequency could have caused something like that. Or I know it slows down brain activity, so we've had radiation around our, it's well documented from police officers and detectives and the STAR team and stuff had found high amounts of radiation and magnetic fields around our vehicle. So we are assuming, we don't know, but it would only make sense that maybe that could be part of what caused it. But again, we're grabbing at straws right now, but we've given it some thought. What happened?
It doesn't make sense that a normal man such as yourself would feel calm and walking toward an alien spacecraft. You probably would feel apprehensive, but what I'm getting at is that they're able to impose on you the emotional state that they want to impose, and they have they have a number of buttons that they can push. They have the ecstasy button that they can push if they need it. They can push the absolute crap your pants fear button that they push. They have the unconditional love button that they push. And I'm just saying that these emotional states, which are often created in experiencers in the midst of persuasive scenarios, like films and symbolic dramas that the aliens create, and then they'll push these emotional buttons. I think one of the ones that is probably the most powerful of the buttons that they're able to push is the unconditional love button, where abductees will report that they were in the presence of aliens and they felt unconditional love. And it's absolutely persuasive to the abductee. They're absolutely become totally convinced that the aliens unconditionally love them. And what I think is going on in those events is that there are technological means for invoking these emotions.
Thomas, do you love them or do you fear them, or how do you feel about them?
Well, there were times. I mean, again, we've had a couple of accounts, and I do remember in our notes from way back when we mentioned having like a godlike calm come over us, and everything seemed to be moving right as if we were underwater. And that was some time ago, but there have been different feelings that we felt I've referenced this 3 moon feeling, like a heightened anxiety, but it's not really an anxiety, it's just like a heightened alertness, or you really can't sleep and you don't know why, and you just you're much more alert. You can't explain it. There's been a lot of little feelings that come and go And that's something that I've made a lot of reference to. So there's definitely something to it. You know, we just believe that the magnetic field or magnetic part of it was probably caused by the craft itself, and that barometric pressure change might go hand in hand with that. But there have been a lot of additional, time.
Have you had an abduction experience recently, or did it just stop when you started going public?
Oh, no. We had our experiences were, well, not mine first, but my parents was 1954, and then 1966, 67, and 69 in New England. And then we didn't have anything happen to us till 2009. But in between, you know, there was a death of my father and a death of Bleckman, and, of course, the people that were investigating it in 2009, a doctor died 8 weeks after going public. So there's
yeah, we're almost out of time. I urge people to listen to our interviews that we've done with you at jerrypippin.com. And we have as you know, we're doing an objective report on your cases and your father had a tragic end, but very interesting experiences right on through his life. And we'll explore all that in a show later in November or early December, so we'll let people know about that. Thomas, you got any parting words?
Yeah, I'd like to maybe bounce 1969 off Elaine. I never really got to finish it. She was talking about some of the things that she was interested in, but if I can just tell you what happened in 69 and see what Elaine feels about it, I'd really appreciate that. Do you have time for that?
Yeah.
Okay. When I was in
we'll take time.
Holding area. Okay. When I was in this larger holding area, which is very similar to what Travis was in, actually, and this was all open to the left, the wall to the right, wall to the back of me, I had walked straight across this area. Again, there was a figure that had been standing in the doorway that was just adjacent to the one I was at, came in a few feet, took me out this walkway, and for the first time I was actually grabbed sternly on my left arm and taken down this hallway. Again, it was all very bright, very self-illuminating, and I went down about maybe 15 feet. I don't think it was more than that, and there was a T junction that I came to with another very thin hallway. You couldn't fit maybe three people down it at once. And I was taking a left and into this room. When I came into this room, there were three figures that I hadn't ever heard anyone else reference that really looked like this. They had large egg-shaped heads, very stick body figure, more of a teardrop type of body in the middle, very, very odd looking. And there were two that seemed to be facing a wall. When I came into this room, they were facing a wall, and they were working on something, I believe, embedded in the wall. And there was a table there off to the right, and there were two figures at the end of this table.